the news.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says that the U.S. is in decline and its threats do not sway independent nations. Iran says it will pursue the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani through international and human rights organizations. And Israeli settlers fire indiscriminately at Palestinians at Flashpoint Al-Quds neighborhood as Israeli soldiers idly stand by. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Now, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says that U.S. threats and sanctions can no longer sway independent nations as American power is in decline. Raisi has made the remarks during a phone call with the Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega. The Iranian president says Washington cannot impose its wishes on Tehran and Managua because both countries rely on their people's votes and support. He also says the two nations have always withstood the excessive demands of hegemonic powers. For his part, Ortega has highlighted Iran and Nicaragua's fight against U.S. imperialism. A senior Iranian official says U.S. was not the only country involved in the assassination of top Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Secretary General of Iran's Human Rights Office, Kazem Gharibabadi, says legal proceedings on the case are underway in Iraq and Iraq, where the attack took place. He says a joint committee of the Iranian and Iraqi judiciary has been formed and is expected to present its findings soon to lay the groundwork for a criminal probe. Gharibabadi says Iran is also pursuing the assassination through international and human rights organizations at the same time. Lieutenant General Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Political commentator Jason Inrue believes the assassination of General Soleimani is an international crime that merits a legal proceeding.
And the United States is not going to do anything about the assassination of Soleimani as ordered by Donald Trump because they still, too, do want him out of the way. They don't want that unifying cooperative force inside of the Middle East that is beyond their control. So it's very obvious this was a crime. This was an international crime, one that begs a response, and it certainly did get a response, but it also requires a legal proceeding, one that, frankly, even if Iran and Iraq carry such a trial out or an investigation, you know, getting Donald Trump to be handed over to the authorities in this case to serve justice is something that's not going to happen. No matter how much the mainstream establishment is displeased with Trump and everything he's done, they're obviously not going to hand him over because that would be a sign of weakness. That would be seen as the U.S. capitulating to Iran, even though the United States is in the wrong in this situation.
Iran strongly slams the holding of a recent Israeli cabinet meeting in Syria's occupied Golan Heights, calling it a provocative act. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, says based on several UN resolutions, the Golan Heights is an inseparable part of the Syrian Arab Republic. Khatibzadeh stresses that Israel's settlement expansion in the Golan cannot change the facts, adding settlers will not be able to reside in the area forever. Israel has announced plans to double the number of its settlers in the occupied Golan Heights. Syria has condemned the move as a dangerous and unprecedented escalation.
Israel captured Syria's Golan Heights in the closing stages of the regime's 1967 war on Arab nations and annexed the occupied territory in 1981 in a move that was not recognized by the international community. The UN Security Council, in its resolution 497, adopted unanimously in December 1981, declared the Israeli decision null and void and without international legal effect. Nonetheless, former U.S. President Donald Trump granted U.S. recognition to Israel's sovereignty over the Syrian territory in 2019. The administration of current President Joe Biden, which remains critical of its predecessor for its unilateral approaches, has not taken any move to reverse the decision. Amid the U.S. blind support, the Israeli premier unveiled a plan on Sunday to double the regime's settler population in the occupied Golan Heights from the current 25,000 with a multi-million-dollar plan. The land is rich in water sources. Naftali Bennett said the move has been prompted by the Trump administration's recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan and the Biden administration's indication that it will not soon challenge that decision. Syria has reacted to Israel's decision to expand the number of Jewish settlers in the occupied Golan Heights, calling it a dangerous and unprecedented escalation and a war crime.
Israel continues with its settlement policy and systematic violations, which are war crimes. The Golan Heights is an integral part of Syrian soil, and we will work to return it in full to the homeland by any means permitted by international law.
In the light of the U.S. backing, Israel has also been expanding its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are illegal under international law. Palestinians believe the U.S. brokered normalization deals between Israel and some Arab states have emboldened the regime to press ahead with its expansionist agenda and land grab policies. But such expansionist policies are just the tip of the iceberg, as acts of violence by Israeli forces and settlers have intensified against Palestinians in the West Bank. That alongside frequent shelling and air raids against the besieged Gaza Strip. The international community has stopped short of taking any practical action in the face of Israel's seizure of Syria's Golan Heights, the occupation of the West Bank, and atrocities against Palestinians as a whole. Israel's aggressive policies will not change the truth that the Golan remains part of Syria, but its fresh expansionist move will create further tensions in a region that has been paying the price of Tel Aviv's destabilization activities.
Israeli settlers opened indiscriminate fire against Palestinians in the occupied East Alqa's neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. According to Palestinian media, Israeli forces stood by idly during the shooting, taking no action to stop it. Israeli forces also reportedly detained a 13-year-old boy in the neighborhood. Sheikh Jarrah has been the scene of crackdowns by Israeli police on Palestinians. Israeli authorities forcibly tried to evict dozens of Palestinian families from the neighborhood, claiming the homes belong to Israelis. Palestinians, however, accuse Israel of trying to make a land grab on their property. Move is seen as part of Israel's efforts to change the demographic character of the occupied territories. The besieged Gaza Strip has hosted a conference on Al-Quds, organized by Al-Quds International Institution. The event underlines that Al-Quds will remain the capital of Palestine. It also stressed keeping up the resistance serves as the only way to put an end to Zionist long-time aggression against Palestinians. Ashraf Shannon has your story.
A big conference titled The Sword of Al-Quds Battle and the Palestinian Issue was held in the Gaza Strip. The Sword of Al-Quds Battle refers to the 11-day war in May. The conference comes almost 7 months after the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days. The Gaza-based resistance groups Miri Hamas and the Islamic Jihad also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzedine Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
East Al-Quds and West Al-Quds serve as incubators for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This Sword of Al-Quds battle sent this clear message to Israel that Al-Quds was and will always be the eternal capital of Palestine. Al-Quds is the compass of the Muslim and Arab nation and has a special place in the hearts and minds of all Muslims.
Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas Movement, Ismail Haniyeh, said, "The resistance will always fight for the sake of Al-Quds."
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance took the initiative and turned the table in fight against the Israeli regime. For 11 days, the resistance in Gaza went on the offensive side instead of being on the defensive side and imposed its will on the enemy.
For more than 7 decades, the Israeli regime has been causing pain and suffering for Palestinians in Al-Quds. Tel Aviv has also increased illegal settlement activities in the holy city.
This conference is of great importance because it stresses the strong connection between Al-Quds and the resistance. The only way to liberate Al-Quds is armed resistance. During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance fighters proved to the whole world that Palestinians in Al-Quds will not be left at the mercy of the Zionist enemy.
Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Russian President Vladimir Putin says his country and Belarus will hold joint military drills on the Belarusian territory in February or March. Putin made the announcement at a meeting with the Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko in St. Petersburg, and it comes amid unprecedented tensions between Moscow and the West over Ukraine, which borders both Russia and Belarus. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden and Putin have scheduled to have a phone call on Thursday. A senior U.S. official said Biden will offer Putin a diplomatic path out of tensions around Ukraine, but remains concerned by Russian troop movements. U.S.-led NATO has stepped up anti-Russia rhetoric, claiming Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine. Moscow denies the allegation. Now, the Pentagon's budget for next year is official, bearing the signature of the U.S. president. And as usual, there is a lot of debate about whether that enormous military spending budget will go to offensive or defensive projects. By many accounts, the largest military budget in the world is associated with wars, but is that criticism justified? In this following report, we'll take a look at how the Pentagon budget gets spent and the role that the U.S. military plays in various countries.
U.S. President Joe Biden has signed the country's massive military budget into law. The bill is called National Defense Authorization Act and authorizes $770 billion in military spending for the fiscal year 2022. The U.S. Senate passed the bill in an 89-10 vote on December 15th, days after the House of Representatives had approved it in a vote of 363-70. The bill allocates $300 million for the so-called Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative and includes $4 billion for the European Defense Initiative, as well as $150 million for Baltic Security Cooperation. It is also designed to counter China by introducing $7.1 billion for the so-called Pacific Deterrence Initiative. Progressive groups and the dozens of lawmakers who voted against the bill have denounced the NDAA, calling for decreasing the budget and allocating more funds for domestic priorities, especially after the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
The States is engaged in military operations of one kind or another all the world, and it needs money to do that.
The U.S. military budget is by far the largest in the world, more than triple that of China, which is the second biggest military spender. The whopping budget is set to add more fuel to the American military-industrial complex to kill more people.
You've got American soldiers still in Germany and Japan, 75 at the end of the war, and you have a Congress that is obsessed with military and defending us against the Russians. There are congressmen, in fact, who demand war with Russia.
For starters, the U.S. now spends more on its military than the next 11 countries combined, and if that's not shocking enough, U.S. has spent about 5,000 about 5,000 military bases overall, 750 of them in 80 countries worldwide. But experts say when the Pentagon talks about a National Defense Act, there's nothing defensive about it. At one point, U.S. was involved in 134 wars, which it described as special operations.
In January 1961, U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower used his farewell address to warn the nation of what he viewed as one of its greatest threats, the military-industrial complex.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence
whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
The military spending bill is now set to pump more money into the military-industrial complex. Trillions of dollars have gone into military hardware companies, contractors, and security firms after 9/11. The military-industrial complex has also recruited powerful lobbyists over the years to ensure hefty budgets and contracts in the Capitol Hill. There are more than 40,000 American troops stationed around the West Asia region. About 900 troops are in Syria on a mission begun by President Barack Obama in 2015, and Biden has said he would direct the military.
Well, the United States is in fact in war all the way around the world. There are some 800 to 1,000 bases. No one is really sure how many. There are thousands of U.S. soldiers around the world. I think there's like 25,000 alone.
To carry out future operations in Afghanistan against emerging terrorist threats, even if they are launched from the bases outside the country. Even with polls showing that the majority of Americans are opposed to new military adventures, the new military-industrial complex continues to easily muster the necessary support from both Democrats and Republicans in Congress. The U.S. just ended its disastrous military campaign in Afghanistan, but that doesn't mean the U.S. wars are over. Its aggressive posture against Russia and especially China has taken a militaristic tone. The U.S. also contributes the most to NATO's budget, and that also means a higher probability of being engaged in military activities.
The United Nations Security Council has condemned a recent massacre in eastern Myanmar in which dozens of civilians were killed. Top body is calling now for accountability and immediate end to all the violence in the Southeast Asian country. It also urged authorities to ensure the safety of civilians. At least 35 civilians died when several vehicles came under attack in the eastern Kaya state on Friday. Victims include women and children whose bodies burnt in this attack. A monitoring group on local media blamed this tragic incident on the military, which seized power in a coup back in February. About 1,300 anti-coup protesters have been killed and thousands arrested since then. And that's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Resistance in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was the most loved and popular Iranian commander for the last decade. He was the symbol of a struggle against oppressors and support for the oppressed. His jihad aimed at a lofty goal, namely, dignity of Islam and saving the oppressed from the yoke of oppressors. General Soleimani's heritage is valor, resistance, inexhaustibility, and self-sacrifice in the way of God. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said in part of his message on the occasion of Qasem Soleimani's martyrdom, "Martyr Soleimani is the international figure of resistance, and all enthusiasts of resistance are avengers of his blood." Resistance is the salvaging way in the face of the domineering system. This doctrine has stemmed from the Quran, and it was highly stressed in the words of Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Khamenei, too, has emphasized on the issue as the only method to rescue the Islamic nations. He says, "The Iranian nation did a great job. In a world which is based on the power, bullying, and pillaging of the powerful and bullies, and the downtrodden nations in many regions of the world are always under the pressure of these bullies, a creature and an identity has taken its head high and explicitly, without consideration, and quite bravely negated this wrong movement of the world, which is the movement of domineering. And we call it as the domineering system. This is the Iranian nation's job. The Iranian nation has negated the domineering system, which is based on the domineering and the domineered. The leader of the Islamic Revolution calls resistance as a religious and human issue. In his view, resistance has various aspects. The most important aspect, however, is trusting God and His promises in the Quran. He points out, resistance is not possible except in the light of faith in God, relying and trust in the divine promises. Almighty God has promised in the Noble Quran and said emphatically, "And surely God will assist those who assist Him." He has promised assistance with emphasis, and this promise will materialize. If we reform ourselves and look at the divine promises optimistically rather than pessimistically, we will triumph. In view of Ayatollah Khamenei, patience and steadfastness are two other aspects of resistance. He believes that God ordered the Prophet from the very beginning of his mission to have patience and perseverance. God told the Prophet in Ayah 7 of Surah Al-Muddathir, "And be patient for the sake of your Lord." He also ordered Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in Ayah 10 of Surah Al-Muzammil, "And be patient over what they say." And in Ayah 112 of Surah Hud, However, God orders the prophet to be resistant along with the faithful. He says, "So be steadfast, just as you have been commanded, and whoever has turned to Allah with you." It is noteworthy that Imam Khomeini used to refer to this ayah as the roadmap for the faithful vis-a-vis the enemies. Ayatollah Khamenei, as the true disciple of Imam Khomeini, believes that patience and steadfastness do not mean indolence and passivity. They rather mean moving and making effort. He says, "Patience does not mean sitting idly and expecting the results and events. Patience means standing, resisting, not changing one's correct and exact calculations with the deception of the enemy. Patience means pursuit of the goals which we have designed for ourselves. Patience means moving and continuing with spirit. This is the meaning of patience." Ayatollah Khamenei points to insight and recognition of enemy as other elements of resistance. He says, "Care should be taken so that one does not make a mistake in recognition of the right way. To be able to find a way in the obfuscation of seditions and to know what the right way. This is the insight." He says elsewhere, "If these two elements, including insight and patience, exist among a nation, the enemy cannot do anything and cannot inflict any damage and will not attain any success in confronting and countering the Islamic system." The leader maintains that insight and recognition of the enemy are more important for officials than the people. He explains, "Nations are always ready for resistance. What is important are the leaders. We have seen in the recent years that wherever the nations moved, showed their resolve and willpower, they achieved results. As there were no leaders who can administer them properly, distinguish the goal properly, and draw up the way in front of the people properly, they failed. The Iranian nation, with the blessing of Imam Khomeini, covered the way properly and took the movement properly, as they had a mighty, aware, and resolute leader who trusted in God and relied in the divine promises." Indefatigable effort is another element of resistance in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. He says, "Once the Islamic Republic was a thin sapling, today it is a pure, robust, and strong tree, which no storm can root it out. Horrendous events occurred, but this nation managed to save itself in these horrendous events and move forward. In the events like the Eight-Year War, the Iranian nation stood strongly and brought the enemies to their knees. And in spite of the enemy, they did not surrender and was not brought to its knees and expanded the domain of its might and dignity." Jihad is one of the main elements of resistance in view of Ayatollah Khamenei. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that jihad is one of the gates of paradise which Allah has opened to his special servants. One of these valiant mujahids of the resistance front was Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani, who received his reward through martyrdom. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Haj Qasim had been exposed to martyrdom 100 times. This was not the first time, but he was scared of nothing in the way of God. fulfilling their duty, and jihad in the way of God. He feared neither the enemy nor the words of such and such, nor still the endurance of labor. Dear listeners, Martyr Soleimani has turned into the code name of resistance and jihad against oppression and sedition.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us again on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. First and foremost, I'd like to apologize for my nasal voice. It's rain season and flus and colds are going around. Secondly, but more importantly, I'm joined by my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamri. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much for being with us. One of the very important questions I feel every guardian should ask themselves, every society, every community should be discussing and exploring, analyzing, and reforming in every way that they can in order to better the whole concept is regarding how to train our youth for the different roles and positions they're going to have to take on in the future. And of course, this show is Muslim Ladies, so we're going to be discussing the steps a guardian, a society, an educational system, or what have you, can have the trainings they can give to their young women, to their girls, for their future. It doesn't just affect the girl, it affects the entire community. Because the more this woman struggles with her roles and her identity and where she is and what position and what duties she has in the society, the more the society is going to be a confused and disoriented one.
The society revolves around men and women,
mm-hmm.
because we have different phases in history of mankind. In the past centuries or so, mm-hmm. there was a lot of attention on women, saying that the whole history, generations to come, revolve around women. And what happened was that so much emphasis and attention was paid to women and women empowerment and redefining gender roles and everything. Too much focus and attention was paid to women. Not enough attention was given to men. Men and women, hand in hand, are wings for a bird to fly, for a person to fly. I always disagree with the idea that you say that it's women, that the whole generation revolves around their, you know, whatever. I totally disagree with that.
Uh-huh.
I think it's men and women hand in hand, because when you caricaturize one part in a society or in the human life system, then your attention is drifted to one specific aspect of life, but then human beings are multi-aspected creatures. Just as much as you have to pay attention to women, enough attention has to be paid to men. And that is why these days in many universities, you don't have women's studies. You don't even have gender studies. The study of men. Because these days, masculine studies is something that's been going on for almost three decades now. Why? Because you see that a lot of families are getting disintegrated. There's not enough peace in the society. We have empowered the women. We have given them equal opportunities for education, equal opportunities for work. We have put them in the spotlight for enough number of years.
Uh-huh.
And it's time to also pay attention to the other sex, which is the masculine sex, and to look at them together as they complete one another. Yes, we were talking about how you have to prepare a girl for the roles that she has in the future. You know, when you're talking about family, when you're talking about the society, a healthy spousal relationship, a healthy family, a healthy workforce,
uh-huh.
a healthy country is one where you have matching, understanding couples, boys and girls, in their moms and dads' houses, in their yep. parents' houses, right?
Yep.
And after marriage, you can go to spouse therapy sessions for 20, 30, 50, 60 sessions, mm-hmm. and some changes may happen. But the root of the problem lies in the years that your child's character and personality is being formed, right? Mm. So as you said, the bringing up, the nourishment, the art of child upbringing in the prime years of their, you know, from zero until their early adulthood, it plays a critical yeah. role in what is to become of this boy and girl in their future life, in all aspects of their life.
For sure.
But then we have different schools of thoughts. In one school of thought, they say that, how are we going to plan for this boy and girl? They say that it's based on nurture. So whatever the society feeds it, whatever your culture feeds that boy or girl, they're going to be brought up with that kind of mindset.
I'm joined by Sister Razia Shamili, and stay with us on this discussion.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So we're back, and we've been talking about how to train our girl for the different roles and positions they're going to have to take on in the future.
Other perspectives, other worldviews believe that it's nature. Your education system, your academic system has to be based on the boys and girls' nature. Mm-hmm. Because in this perception, the nature of a human being is the same throughout the entire creation. A woman is a woman, was a woman, will be a woman in the next centuries, in the past centuries. So the nature of human beings is intact. They say that what is permitted, what is lawful in Islam, that, you know, Prophet Muhammad announced to us, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, it will stay halal until the end of time. Why is this so? Because the rulings of Islam are based on our nature, and the nature stays intact. But then there are new things happening in society,
constantly
happening. But then we have to be careful not to contaminate this God-given nature and to create your own version of humanity. That is, like, what I'm saying is that these days, you know, we're saying that why should men be the qawwam of families? I'm talking about how girls should be prepared for their future roles. But before that, we have to know, based on which perspective are you talking
exactly.
about? Whose side
what
are you on?
Of thought,
which school of
right.
thought are you on?
What mentality do you have toward life and your role in it?
Exactly. So, like, these days, as I was giving you a tangible example, they say, we don't want a patriarchal family where the man is the head of the family and the woman, she just has to submit and say, oh, yes, my master. They say, what's wrong with partnership? What's wrong with a democratic family? Women have, you know, their brains have developed so much. That was for the past. Islam.
Exactly, and it's not like it had such a wonderful outcome.
They say that back in the time of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, women's minds were still underdeveloped. They
yeah,
still needed to grow up.
They stopped killing their women alive like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, now Rasulullah is like, okay, guys, we're... I'm so proud of you guys that you've managed to stop killing your women the moment they were born. How about now take care of them? Thus enter Qawwamun.
By Qawwamun, I meant it's the term that's been used in the Quran, Nisa 34, uh-huh. which means caretakers, managers, maintainers
yeah,
of
exactly.
women. What's wrong with not giving women enough power? Well, you know, if you, as a woman, if you earn more money, if your income is so much more, why don't you work outside and why don't you let your husband with low income to stay at home and take care of the kids? Mm-hmm. This is the outcome. This is the result of the democratic family, right? Mm-hmm. But then what happens is that in practice, yes, you have empowered women. Yes, women earn a lot of money, and
they can contribute. It's not just a question of earning money. It's a question of it's contribution. If a woman is a really good engineer, she's a really good architect, she's a really good doctor, why must she stay at home and change diapers when she can go out and contribute? That's all I'm saying.
Uh-huh. Change diapers. Change whose diapers?
Her child's.
A human being's diaper.
Yeah, well,
it's not like a dog's diaper or a cat's diaper. We're talking about, actually, as you said, let's not mix things up, because giving women the autonomy to get educated, actually, it's a hadith that says it's the duty of every Muslim man and woman to go seek knowledge.
Exactly.
This is no,
it's gender neutral.
No question about it. Then working. No question about it. Women in Islam have the permission, they have the freedom to choose to work, and their husband. And if prior to their working, they've been employed in a governmental position, their husbands cannot, because you have to ask your husband's permission when you want to leave the house. That's like one of the parts
rights
of tamkin,
yeah.
Rights of men, right? But even in this scenario, if this woman has been employed and has been in a contract with the government, then the man has no right to say that I'm not going to let you to leave the house. Uh-huh. It's out of the hands of the man. I mean, there's a lot of
factors at play.
Factors and complications about it.
We're going to go on a short break, and we're going to be right back, so don't go anywhere.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Generally speaking, if you prioritize the roles of a woman based on which stage in her life she is, then you shouldn't deprive her of something, of a talent that, or of a special skill that she has, she possesses, that she can contribute to the society.
That's exactly.
No one said you should lock her inside and she should change diapers. Mm. But this, even changing diapers, the more you study about the development of a human being, you realize that all this love, even the time of changing diapers, even the time of breastfeeding, which might seem to be like, for women who have gone through these tiresome and sometimes, of course, obviously beautiful stages of life, all these little sparkles of love that you give that infant of yours later on, in their life, when they become kids, when they become adolescents, when they enter into life themselves, when they become husbands and wives, and when they go to the work, this love will be reflected in their personality. In the Quran, it says that if you give life to one person, it's as if you have given life to the whole
world.
To the whole world, Zainab. It's quality, not quantity. It's not just one person. This one person changes the whole world. This Imam Khomeini, this one person changed the whole world. This prophet, this one man changed the whole world. This Lady Fatima, this one lady, this Lady Zainab, this one lady changed the whole world. It's not just one person.
I think it's safe to say that they were absolute exceptions.
No, you can be. Imam Khomeini was an absolute exception.
He was.
Gandhi was an absolute exception.
Yes, he was.
We have a lot of exceptions.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
world is waiting for exceptions to pop out. Why not bring giving birth, giving nourishment, giving love, giving attention to this one person?
Thank you so very much, Sister Razia.
Thank
you for your attempts, and thank you for your efforts. And your very insightful pointers and reminders, which I also constantly enjoy. And thank you to our listeners for being with us on this episode of Muslim Lady. For more of such discussions, tune in to future episodes of the show. Until then, I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return. La ilaha
the Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
One analyst warned the West Virginia Democrats' obstruction of his party's legislative agenda puts the economic recovery at risk. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Manchin Under Fire for Blown Potential $60 Billion Hole in U.S. Economy During Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Beyond its near, immediate, and potentially devastating impact on millions of families with children, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin's obstruction of his party's Build Back Better package could have far-reaching consequences for the overall U.S. economy as the coronavirus pandemic continues to rage at home and abroad. According to a Business Insider calculation derived from Goldman Sachs' new adjusted growth projections, the death of Democrats' $1.75 trillion reconciliation measure could deprive the U.S. economy of $60 billion in gross domestic product, GDP, over the next three quarters, hampering the nation's fragile recovery. The outlet noted economists are already forecasting what a BBB-free economy would look like, and early projections are gloomy. Goldman Sachs economists, led by Jan Hatzius, now expect U.S. GDP to grow 2% in the first quarter, 3% in the second quarter, and 2.75% in the third quarter, according to estimates published recently. Those projections are down from 3%, 3.5%, and 3%, respectively. The financial services firm's Moody's Analytics, for its part, projected earlier this year that passage of both the reconciliation bill and the bipartisan infrastructure package, which President Joe Biden signed into law last month, would boost real GDP growth to 4.8% next year. Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's, warned in a series of tweets recently that if BBB doesn't become law, real GDP growth in 2022 will be lower by 0.5%, and reaching full employment next year will prove elusive. Fallout will be quick as families with children will lose a tax break, he continued. Without BBB, the economic recovery will be vulnerable to stalling out if we suffer another serious wave of the pandemic. An increasingly likely scenario with Omicron spreading rapidly. Detractors of BBB worry about inflation, but without it, the worry is more likely to be growth. Democrats' flagship social spending and climate legislation proposed investing billions of dollars in safety net programs, including an expanded child tax credit, Medicaid, and pre-K, and renewable energy initiatives over the next decade in an effort to cut poverty, bolster healthcare coverage, and combat the planetary emergency. According to an analysis conducted by the Economic Policy Institute in October, the slate of policy proposals in the Build Back Better Act combined with the bipartisan infrastructure package would have supported 4 million jobs annually. But over several months of negotiations, Manchin and other right-wing Democrats slowly chipped away at the legislation, removing key climate and healthcare provisions and ultimately cutting the bill's proposed spending level in half. Manchin dealt what many saw as the death blow, telling Fox News that he would vote no on the Build Back Better Act should it reach the floor in its current form, likely spelling the end of programs like the expanded child tax credit, which reduced poverty and bolstered consumer spending by putting money directly in families' pockets.
Behind the scenes, Manchin reportedly told colleagues that he thought parents would waste monthly child tax credit CTC programs on drugs, and instead of providing for children, ignoring research showing that families have largely spent the money on groceries and other necessities. In a statement released to the public recently, the West Virginia Democrat offered several other objections to the bill that economists and other analysts slammed as nonsensical. He says he's worried about inflation and the national debt, but Build Back Better will be paid for with tax increases on big corporations and the wealthy, so it won't have any bearing on inflation or debt. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich wrote in a blog post following Manchin's statement. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich says he's worried about the impact of the latest COVID surge on the economy. But if COVID slows the economy, there is even more justification for federal spending that strengthens social safety nets. He says he can't face his constituents in West Virginia without renouncing Build Back Better. But on a per-person basis, West Virginians would be among the biggest beneficiaries of the legislation in all of America. One out of four West Virginians over 65 have no natural teeth, for example, the highest rate in the nation. Biden's original bill provided dental benefits under Medicare. Despite Manchin's opposition, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wrote in a letter to his caucus recently that he intends to bring the Build Back Better Act to the floor for a vote early in the new year, so that every member of this body has the opportunity to make their position known on the Senate floor, not just on television. We are going to vote on a revised version of the House-passed Build Back Better Act, and we will keep voting until we get something done, Schumer added, without offering specific details on what the adjusted bill would look like. In a statement, Groundwork Collaborative Executive Director Lindsay Owens argued that if Senator Manchin is concerned about inflation, then he should join us in fighting back against the corporate profiteering that is driving it, rather than trying to derail legislation that will not impact inflation one bit. The economic case for Build Back Better is crystal clear. Putting more money into people's pockets helps families participate fully in our economy. Investing in childcare and paid leave helps workers stay healthy and return to work. And tackling the climate crisis is essential to building a more resilient and sustainable future, Owens said. Pressing and passing the Build Back Better Act isn't just about ensuring that Senator Manchin honors his commitments. It's about building an economy that works for all families, not just the wealthy and well-connected, she continued. Especially given the new COVID variant and rising economic uncertainty, it's more important than ever for Congress to stand up to the corporate interest who benefit from this broken status quo and put us on the path to economic resilience by passing the Build Back Better Act in full without further delay.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.